Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but none of what we discuss replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Cancer. When you hear that word, going to the doctor, you often don't hear anything else after that. If any of us or our loved ones have ever been diagnosed with cancer, it's often that moment when you just feel like this is the time and you get a diagnosis, and often it can be one of the scariest moments of your life. When you get that diagnosis, often anything else the doctor or anyone else will say to you that day might just be something you can't even comprehend, because the concept of having cancer just takes over everything in your life. But what are some simple things that you can do, and what are some plans that you can make if you ever get diagnosed or if one of your loved one does, to actually help to make sure that what you do is the most appropriate, up-to-date, and keeping on top of all the various difficulties that happen when you get diagnosed with something like cancer? Now, today we're going to talk about all different types of cancer because there are many different facets of this disease. And as people know, the treatment for cancer varies based on the illness. So you may know that if you get diagnosed with a breast cancer or a colon cancer or melanoma, skin cancer, or any other type, it may be entirely different than the treatment that you may get for a different type of tumor. So today we're going to be talking with Dr. Shane Morita, and he is currently Queen's Surgical Oncology Program Director, and he's also participating in a variety of different research trials here in the islands. And we're going to be talking about what happens when you get that diagnosis. What should you do, and what is a really good game plan to have in mind, not only for the person who's diagnosed, but also for the friends and family around that person so that they can also be helpful as well. Now, as always, you can join us at 941-3689 or toll-free from our neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Now, Dr. Morita, you have been with us several times. Welcome back to The Body Show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, I'm so glad you're here because, you know, we've talked specifically about different types of cancer before, but what we really haven't done is go over the big, broad overview and basics of what happens when you're diagnosed and what are some things that we as clinicians know that people should do, but often it isn't something that comes to mind immediately when they get the diagnosis. So let's talk a little bit about what it is that happens when somebody finds something that turns out to be malignant. When someone presents to your office, sometimes the diagnosis is still not yet established. Is that correct?
Correct.
So in that case, they might have symptoms, or they might have had a mass that was found either on exam or on a scan. What should they do if there's still a question about what the diagnosis is? And how can they best help themselves to prepare before they find out what it is?
Well, I mean, you know, you have an open relationship with your healthcare provider, you know, whether it's going to be a biopsy or what have you. But once you get the diagnosis, or if you ever do, don't panic. I mean, it's happened to me with my family, my father, for example. So I always tell people really five things, if you will. Number one is get a folder and become very organized so you have all of your documents together in one place. Number two, do some background research on the web. I recommend the NCI, National Cancer Institute, or the American Cancer Society. The more you know, the better it'll make sense when you go in for subsequent evaluations and appointments. Number three, have a huddle with your core, your family member, your friends, and say, you know, what questions and answers will I want when I leave that appointment? And number four, bring someone with you to the appointment, because sometimes that person may or may not be able to say something that you may have forgotten to ask your physician. And number five, really, I think it's pretty basic, but it's something that's often get overlooked, is get a timeline from your physician. You know, sometimes it takes, you know, some time to arrange for some testing and whatnot, but get a timeline so that you know and there's no miscommunication from that end.
So let's take a look at each one of these issues individually. The first one, you said, don't panic. So you'll see people before it's determined that they have cancer. And if you need to do a biopsy or you need to remove something, then they may have a surgery to do that. And subsequent to that, they come in to get results. So regardless of what the results are, a lot of people's first thought when they hear the word cancer is, chemotherapy, I'm going to lose my hair, radiation, I've got to be off of work. I mean, they go from, and I've seen this in my own office, they go from point A to point Z right there within a couple of split seconds. So don't panic. Not all cancers require treatment with some of the things that we think about. Not all cancers require chemotherapy. Not all cancers require radiation. Treatment is going to be personalized to you based on the type of cancer and based on what the needs are.
Correct. And obviously the staging, you know, you want to know, is the cancer, did the cancer spread to other parts of the body, or is it somewhat localized? And maybe, as you said, maybe they may not need chemotherapy or radiation therapy or even now immunotherapy.
So if we were to say staging, what is involved in the staging? So if somebody has, let's just say, a thyroid lump that is palpated, it's found by their doctor, they see you, you take a piece of it, and it looks like it's cancer. How would, for any type of cancer, how would the staging process take place? Is that something that's based on what you've taken out of the body or other scans showing the rest of the body or a combination of both?
Well, for example, you mentioned thyroid. So if someone has a thyroid cancer, and the most common is papillary thyroid cancer, the next step that I would do would be to get a neck ultrasound, because I want to see if there's any other lymph nodes that potentially are involved, because thyroid cancer, like other cancers, like to spread or can spread to the lymph nodes, and that may change my operation.
So just because you're diagnosed with cancer doesn't mean the stage is immediately known right then and there.
Correct.
So you may need to get some information on staging.
Some imaging or whatnot.
Scans or exactly. Some other type of testing to figure that out.
Correct.
So don't panic, because a lot of people panic. And I think even just as human beings, if I sat in a room and someone said, yep, that's cancer, there's a little part of me that's still going to panic because, you know, we kind of think way too far ahead. So don't panic is number one. Now, you mentioned also do your own research. And I'm curious because a lot of people, I know most people do. They do look things up on the web. They do look things up on other venues, and they ask their friends and they ask other people. You encourage that, but yeah, only to certain websites.
Yeah, I mean, just two basic websites that I trust. I think I try to tell people avoid blogs, because blogs are sometimes can be, you know, we don't know how consistent that information is and how accurate. I would just say, you know, the National Cancer Institute, you know, via the NIH, government funded. But it gives you just basic information, and they actually have a professional as well as a patient-based sort of perspective. And then number two is American Cancer Society, you know, nonprofit organization that is very much involved with research, but it will give you a fundamental knowledge of what cancer type you're dealing with.
Now, I often refer patients to the Mayo Clinic website or Johns Hopkins website or, you know, Massachusetts General if they want to get some additional information. I kind of hesitate to suggest that people just Google their symptoms, because there are so many different things that you can find on the symptoms that are absolutely not accurate. But also, there's also the scary stories. You know, I think sometimes we forget that. You mentioned blogs. When people start to mention their own personal experiences, you know, it's like not everybody goes to Vegas and wins $1 million. I hope I'm one of them someday, but that's probably not going to happen. However, those that do might write a lot about it. So depending on who is writing the blog or what personal experience this is, it's kind of limited to that one person's experience. And everybody's experience may be slightly different. So keep your mind open to looking at some of the major cancer centers. You mentioned National Cancer Institute, run through the NIH. You mentioned the American Cancer Society. Places that will provide some unbiased technical medical information in layman's terms that are easy to read.
Correct.
Now, the third thing you mentioned is huddle with your family and loved ones. Who should be in the huddle? Who should be there with you having this discussion?
You know, your closest friend or just your closest family member, but that way that person can knows you more than anybody else, better than anybody else, and they're able to, I think, see what your best interests are and know sort of what information you're going to need to ask when you go and get, you know, on that first appointment, that consultation for treatment.
So should that person be someone who comes with you, if possible?
If possible. I mean, that's always, I think, something that I highly encourage.
Optimally, you know, if you have an extra set of ears, I'll suggest, is, you know, because sometimes you hear something and you might not remember it, or even if you're in the midst of treatment, sometimes you might not be thinking as well as you normally would. So bring a buddy, bring an extra set of ears, and have that extra set of ears, have a hand to write stuff down for you so Correct. That they can actually help take notes should there be an issue. And when you've seen folks who have done this, who have had maybe their whole family make a list of top 20 questions of what they really need to know, has that individual wound up having a better time handling their care because they know more about what to expect?
I think so. And it also, I think it improves communication and just the overall experience.
Because a lot of times, if you know what to expect, then you really can keep yourself up to date and feel more comfortable with the process.
Exactly.
Now, you also talked about knowing your timeline. For all different types of cancer treatments, there's different timelines. There's when you should do your initial diagnosis, when you do a repeat follow-up scan, when you schedule various different procedures, whether it be needing certain types of IVs or ports, which are catheters underneath the skin or whatever it may be. So really know what to expect and when to expect it. Have there been situations where people have thought, okay, I'm going to do a scan at some point and waiting for authorization and maybe don't hear anything and no news is good news, and then maybe it just doesn't happen as quick as it should?
Yeah, I think the patients need to know that there are sometimes there's barriers, but, you know, with a phone call or two or just some extra documentation, I think, you know, it can be in a timely fashion. But there are some challenges, but the key is to get with your physician or healthcare provider to make sure you're both on the same page. You know, if I tell a patient, you know, soon, you may interpret that as tomorrow, like we're going to do your surgery tomorrow, for example, or I may think of it, you know, within the week. So, you know, everybody has a different time frame and what their definition of, you know, of quick is or soon is.
And be fairly specific,
exactly.
If at all possible. And sometimes things are delayed for reasons that are beyond anyone's fault. If you have a really difficult time with certain types of chemotherapy and your immune cells don't come back quick enough, you might have to have a delay in your next cycle of that treatment. And that doesn't mean that everything's going to get worse while you're delaying. It means that your body's trying to have some time to recover. So that any delay does not necessarily mean disastrous delay.
Sure.
It's medically appropriate for you.
Absolutely.
Now, have you come across the concept of a patient navigator?
Oh, absolutely. They're extremely valuable. We use it at Queens Cancer Center, and they help really, they're sort of GPS for our patients to help coordinate appointments and a lot of traveling. I see a lot of folks from the neighbor island, so they're extremely valuable.
So if someone is seeking treatment from an oncologist, how would they be able to access a patient navigator?
Well, it can be at the first appointment. They can be introduced after the initial encounter, sometimes even beforehand, especially when they're coming from rural areas or from neighbor islands. They've already been made contact because of travel coordination. So,
now let's talk about our friends in the neighbor islands, because I think a lot of times there's such an advantage to living out of the hustle and bustle of the city. And anytime I've ever gone to a neighbor island, I've thought, I could picture living here. And then I come back and I'm like, I'm really happy I'm still living here. So there are advantages and disadvantages, but medically, one of the difficulties that some of our folks have on the neighbor islands would be the thought that maybe their treatment can't be provided locally. But that's not always the case. You go to some of the neighbor islands, is that right?
Yeah, I go and see some follow-up patients in Hilo, and Queens has already brought on a medical oncologist on board in Kamuela. And so, I mean, there are resources available. You know, I mean, chemotherapy, for example, chemotherapy can be given in most instances at, you know, in the neighbor islands without any major issues.
So follow-ups, often you will go there. If someone needs a major surgery, they may need to come to Oahu to have that procedure. But then there's no reason why they can't go back and be amongst their loved ones and friends and family around the neighbor islands as well.
Sure.
Now, a lot of folks have sort of a myth that cancer just happens to old people. True or false?
You know, that's not true. You know, unfortunately, we see patients that are extremely young. We see folks that you would never think would get cancer, and they do. And, you know, we've all seen that recently as well. So,
So really, this could happen to someone at any age. Just feeling like, hey, I'm too young to have this happen. Granted, some particular cancers may be more likely as you get older, but it certainly doesn't exclude. There is no age exclusion. It's very non-discriminatory.
Exactly, and I wish cancer was discriminatory, but it's not. You know, different ages, different genders, you know, different races. It really just affects everyone. And even if you yourself are not affected, if you have a loved one that's affected, it really impacts the whole dynamic.
And if you happen to be the person who is the buddy for your loved one who goes to all of their appointments, you've got a really hefty job.
Yes.
And that's not just being their medical liaison, helping to take notes and be there medically, but it's also usually also helping to take care of them once they go home as well.
Absolutely. When my father was diagnosed, he had terminal cancer, and it was already had metastasized to his brain. I mean, my mother was there, you know, by his side, and so it really impacts everyone.
It does, and that's really hard. I think one of the things that we often underappreciate is the fact that, you know, and you mentioned about your parents, and our parents get older. And we have this view of them from when we were younger that they're like indestructible and can handle anything and can do all these different things because they always did when we were young. And yet sometimes we forget that, you know, like your mom is older, like my parents are older, and they may not be able to do all the things that I expect that they would do because as with time, they have had various medical problems and maybe their memory doesn't work as well or their coordination isn't as strong or whatever it might be. It might not be the way that it used to be when I was younger. So kind of adopting that role as a child, knowing that you have to almost parent your parent for certain situations is really a transition that's difficult to make. And so, you know, I give you a lot of credit for being that person. It must be, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about this next week. It must be hard when things happen in doctors' families.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I didn't do a good job. I'll be real honest. When my father was diagnosed in April of 2004, so, you know, 12 years ago, I didn't handle it well. You know, it's just a shock. So, I mean, all this advice I'm trying to pass on, it's just learning from experience that, you know, it's challenging, but hopefully I think some folks can learn from my mistakes.
Well, we've all made them. You know, I think sometimes when you're in the medical profession and everyone looks at you expecting that you'll be able to handle all of it, it's difficult because you know enough to know a little too much about what you know. And that can just head you down a totally different direction as far as thinking about what potentially could happen in the future. And it's hard to express that to family members and yet still give them hope and be optimistic at the same time based on what you've seen. So it certainly sounds like there's a lot that we could all learn, really, about experiences dealing with how cancer affects every different facet of life, whether you be the person who is diagnosed, their closest loved one, friend, or family, or even just family member who is dramatically affected by all of this. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Shane Morita, and we are talking today about what happens when you get diagnosed with cancer. What are some of the steps that you should take to make sure that you're getting the most optimal care and treatment? And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about how to know if what treatment you're getting is really the same as if you were to go to another major medical center. There are some ways to find out, and we have some great news to share with you about that. Now, if you or a loved one has ever been diagnosed with cancer, or if you've learned something like Dr. Morita has learned about how you could handle this better in the future, or some little trick that really helped you, please share, because what you've learned may help somebody else, and that's really what it's all about here on The Body Show. You can join us at 941-3689, toll-free from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
Zach Noyle is a surf photographer who has braved waves all over the world, in the process creating indelible images of some of the world's best. He's revealing some of his secrets in an upcoming lecture, and he'll join us in our studio tomorrow morning at 8 on The Conversation.
In NPR News asked Americans how their lives have changed in 8 years. Then we asked the man who's been president for those years.
I've been frustrated by some things that I did not complete, that I couldn't wrap and mail and ship before I got out of here.
I'm Steve Inskeep. What President Obama wishes he could have done in part two of our documentary on Obama's years.
Tuesday evening at 7.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and we're here live in the studio. I have Dr. Shane Morita in the studio. He is a surgical oncologist, and he is the director of the Queen Surgical Oncology Program. He's actually the chief editor of a textbook that's going to be coming out. And so when you hear that he's, quote, written the book on it, literally, Shane, you've written the book on it. So we're talking a little bit about different facets of surgical oncology and, in fact, cancer of any type, because this really does affect everyone in a family, in a group of loved ones, for your friends. It affects all of us. When you hear that word, it can be devastating. We're going to talk about what to do after that. Now, this show is your conversation as well. And as always, we have open phone lines should you want to express what you've experienced if you've been diagnosed or tricks that you've learned that have helped you. You can always give us a holler at 941-3689. Toll free Neighbor Islands 877-941-3689. Now, before the break, Dr. Morita, we were talking about some tips that you've learned over the course of your life and years of experience as an oncologist, and also just as a son dealing with the difficulty of your father being sick. And I'll go over those briefly. Don't panic. Get organized, research, get a folder, really. Put in a lot of your medical information, scan information, paperwork, because a lot of times you don't remember what's told to you. And if you have this hard copy, it's really helpful. Do some research. You know, you've encouraged it. Go to the National Cancer Institute website. Go to the American Cancer Society website and take a look and see what you can find out so that you're a more educated person and know a little bit more about what's going on. Have that important discussion with friends and family and loved ones. And really talk about what your goals are, wishes are, questions. Write down information and bring someone with you to take notes. And then you talked about the timeline, about knowing what scans and what treatments are done at what times, so you can really plan ahead. Now, when we talk about having this multidisciplinary approach, you're a surgical oncologist, so you will do surgery to take out whatever this tumor is of wherever it happens to be, and then help to coordinate care with a team of other people. Who else is on the team?
Well, we have patient navigators. We have oncology nurses, coordinators, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists. It's really a very large team. And so the importance of knowing, it's not only the type of therapy, but the timeliness. Should it be done before surgery? Will it need to be done after surgery? So I think all that is important. So that dovetails in what we do, where we do, we conduct tumor boards. So there we'll have pathology, the slides review. We'll have a radiologist there going over all the imaging modalities of a particular patient that we select. And we have the stakeholders there who are going to be involved in taking care of the patients and for most instances available.
So what would tumor board look like? This is a meeting that doctors are present at and whoever else is involved in the team of care. So it's not necessarily the patient being present, but all of the doctors, whether it be the surgical oncologist, medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, everybody would be in a room, and also the pathologist looking at the slides. So everybody would kind of pick up a case, the same case, discuss it, and establish what would be the best care.
Correct.
And that care is based on national guidelines.
National guidelines. And we also have clinical trial members there, part of the team, who may say, you know what, we have a trial here, for example, in collaboration with the UH Cancer Center. Was this discussed? So everybody is there to help each other.
And that's the key, is that when people ask, well, how does the Cancer Center actually collaborate with the doctors? That's how they do it. So there's research taking place at the UH Cancer Center, and a lot of that research is being translated into clinical practice and clinical trials. So there would be somebody present at the tumor board who might know about what the trials are and therefore be able to let everybody involved know, could this person be a candidate for a trial, or maybe not because of their type of tumor or their staging or whatever it might be. Is it always good to be in a clinical trial?
You know, I think a clinical trial, I always recommend to look into. We don't know the actual answer, and that's why it's called a clinical trial. But I think a lot of therapies that have been approved have all gone through the path of clinical trials. I mean, look at Herceptin, right? Also known as trastuzumab for breast cancer. That was FDA approved in 1998 and really one of the first types of targeted therapy. So without clinical trials, I think we don't know enough information. And so we can better, I think, help patients in the future. For example, melanoma, right, and even lung cancer. Now a lot of it is being treated with immunotherapy.
Well, we're going to talk some more about immunotherapy in just a few moments. We have Susie on the line from Kauai. Susie, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, thank you.
What can we do for you today?
Well, just listening to both of you talking about it as medical professionals, I'm a speech pathologist by training, and, I work a lot with people with swallowing problems and disorders. And when my mom got Barrett's esophagus or esophageal cancer, I had to really figure out that I needed to set my professional life aside because I could not bring it into the room with the family. It was just too much for them. And I think that's just basically what I want to say is just, as a medical person is when you're in that kind of situation, you're very terrified anyway, even though, you have that medical background, which I think can make it a little worse, but sometimes the family, the rest of the family, really doesn't want to hear it all.
Really good point, Susie, is that you know too much. So when you answer their questions, sometimes it's just not all they want to hear. I'm curious, did you find it difficult to put your medical knowledge sort of outside of the room when you were dealing with your mom's cancer?
Yes. And it definitely caused some very hard feelings because I became very, I wanted to be very much a proactive for my mom. And if there was something I didn't agree with, I was very verbal about it. And it was very disturbing to my the other parent, my dad. And I just realized that I had to sit back and just let things unfold, ask the questions you need to as a daughter, make suggestions, but don't own them. Just like you would with somebody you're working with. You make the recommendations and then you stand back and let them make their decisions and you don't hold on to your opinion. You let them make the choice that's best for them, even within that family unit. Because I come from a fairly good-sized family, with a very strong matriarchal mother, and, it was a very interesting experience, yes.
Well, and I thank you for sharing that, because I'm sure, Dr. Morita, you had a similar situation where you know too much, and then if you wind up questioning some of the treatments or therapies. And I can imagine you're also on the receiving end of this now. So you know a lot and you'll counsel families, some of whom you may have colleagues whose family members are the ones you're treating. And it's got to put you in a position where, you witness what the family is going through and kind of understand that dynamic.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Cancer, getting a diagnosis is not only, I think a burden on the patient, but just the family dynamics, which will change. And so but I do see a lot of positive situations where, sometimes family members have been somewhat estranged from this, particular patient. They'll sort of come together and regroup. So I think, even though we never want to use cancer as a good reason to bring everyone together, I think, there are some things that, it happens in life for some reason. We don't really know why, but I think having a good support system, whether it's family, friends, is extremely important. I mean, it really tears me up inside when I have to go to the waiting room and there's nobody there, or there's nobody that I need to call, as far as there's no family or friend that is involved in this patient's life. So it's difficult.
Well, and Susie, thank you for bringing up such a good point that you know, it's not just when you have that medical professional knowledge that you are the family member who's dealing with, you know, the family dynamics, but recognize that all of the members of your team also are medical professionals, and they want to make sure that their patient, who is their priority, your mother in this case, or whomever the loved one may be, also has that strong support network, because that helps people do better when they have that group of people who care about them, who help them, who do simple things like call them up to say how you're doing, or bring them food that might be soft if they can't eat so much yet, or whatever the case may be. So it's a difficult task, Susie. I appreciate you for sharing that. And if you have something you'd like to share, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak with Dr. Shane Morita here in the studio. We're talking about oncology. We're talking about cancer. When you get that diagnosis, what happens? And if you've learned some tricks over the years that have helped you to deal with this, either individually as a person or because some of your loved ones may have had the same experience, you can always join us at 941-3689, toll free 877-941-3689. Now, we were talking just a few moments ago about how does the Cancer Center collaboration occur, and there is that collaboration or translation of the research directly into what's going on with the oncology practices here in the islands. So there is a connection, and that connection is often this multidisciplinary team called Tumor Board. And depending on what particular type of cancer you have, there's different members of that team for you. If you need radiation, a radiation oncologist may be on your team. If you don't, they may not be present on that team. But it really does all take place in sort of a collaborative, cohesive fashion.
Correct.
You mentioned something that I want to spend a little time on, immunotherapy, because that's sort of the latest in what we're doing in cancer. And it seems like maybe 20 years ago or so, we treated a lot of cancers very similarly. We treated a lot of breast cancers in one way. We treated a lot of colon cancers in another way, lung cancer in another way. And for that time, those treatments were as successful as they could have been. But now we're looking more at genetics and what's going on with the tumor. And so it seems to me like immunotherapy is the beginnings of what is going to be an entire shift in cancer care towards more personalized cancer treatment based on individual tumors.
Right. I mean, for example, solid tumors. I'll give you an example. In 2002, imatinib was FDA approved to treat a type of solid tumor called GI stromal tumor, GIST. And you know, really back then, solid tumors were not treated with any type of what we call targeted therapy now. Fast forward, you know, when I was at the NCI about 10 years ago, I remember taking care of some of these patients who underwent immunotherapy. And lo and behold, I find out that in 2011, a drug called ipilimumab is FDA approved for melanoma, also known as Yervoy. And so that has really, immunotherapy the last several years has really changed. It's been a paradigm shifter in treating a lot of solid cancers, melanoma, lung cancer, even lymphoma is treated with anti-PD-1 inhibitors.
So tell me a little bit more about what you mean by targeted therapy, because you know, you or I may understand what we mean by immunotherapy and targeted therapy, but you understand it better than I do. I'm absolutely certain of that. So how would you describe to a patient or family members, how would you describe what targeted therapy is? And what does that mean when we say immunotherapy?
Okay, so targeted therapy to me is a little different from immunotherapy. So in targeted therapy, we are looking at a particular signal or pathway, something in the pathway of what drives the tumor to grow, looking as that as the main sort of chief reason why it's growing, and giving a drug. It can be a pill, can be an IV medicine, but oftentimes it's a drug. It's a pill that's given orally, and it can by mouth, and it can at least halt tumor growth.
So we're talking about a genetic aspect that this tumor has them grow?
Yeah, it's a mutation. So there's different type of mutations. One is called germline, which is something that's happened within, that's sort of passed on. But a lot of these mutations I'm talking about and signals are somatic. So they're acquired. They're not within, you're not born with it. It's within the tumor itself. So I'll give you one that's very, that's pretty well known, and that's BRAF, and that started in 2011 with a drug called vemurafenib, also known as Zelboraf, that targeted this type of mutation within the tumor of the melanoma cells. But what we found is that even after they get a good response, the tumor is so smart that it'll mutate. It'll find an escape pathway. So there's different strategies to combat that. But targeted therapy is not. I think it'll work in concert with other types of therapy, but sometimes it's not the end all.
Could we describe it as similar to, and this is just a real broad kind of similarity, to like targeted antibiotics, that sometimes bacteria can become resistant to it because it's found a way around it. It's found a way to pump the antibiotic out of the system, or it's found a way to not even let it in the different cells. So that just like certain tumors, just like certain people can become resistant to an antibiotic if the bacteria develops some ability to get around it, sometimes tumors will initially respond and then develop a way around it and find some way to no longer respond to that particular targeted treatment. So there's ways that you find a different target so that you can, it might be this moving target, but you can try and find a way to shrink the tumor or stop it from growing from a different aspect.
Right. Or you add another drug, you add another targeted drug. And we do that sometimes in melanoma. I do want to mention, you had asked me to address immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is a little different from targeted therapy in the fact that immunotherapy, basically you're getting medicines, drugs such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab that are used now to treat melanoma and lung cancers. But it's basically these medicines are given and they're used to essentially enhance your immune system. So your body's own self-defense get revved up. The T cells, there's different cells within your body, and they go and combat the cancer for you.
So it's kind of targeted therapy may be treating directly the tumor, and then immunotherapy is stimulating your immune system's ability
exactly
to try and take care of that tumor itself.
Correct.
So maybe it's a silly question, but if your immune system could take care of the tumor, why wouldn't it have done so already?
Because it's not only because cancers are very tricky. They have different mutations. They have different, different targets. They have different mechanism of escaping. Remember now, cancer patients, get in trouble because a cancer is basically like a weed that loses control and sucks all the nutrients, for lack of a better word. And I think immunotherapy can be complementary, but there's just different ways of why cancers develop.
So the immunotherapy actually stimulates the immune system so that if it was trying to take care of the tumor but just couldn't do it, then the immunotherapy would help to stimulate, kind of like sending extra troops.
Exactly.
Because you've got a battle, so you've got to fight this. You need some more backup. You need reserves.
Exactly.
So that would help to treat it as well. Do you ever wind up becoming immune to the immunotherapy? That sounds like a paradox.
Well, I mean, what I've seen patients experience is they get side effects that actually they hurt their immune system, or they, sometimes they get, for example, I'll give you the drug that we talked about, ipilimumab. I had a patient that experienced that, but there are side effects because what it does is it can cause damage to the pituitary gland, and that's a gland in your brain that makes a lot of hormones. So this person needs supplementation for that. So I will be discussing that a little bit further in the seminar in a couple of days, but I think it's really important to know that some of these medications are not without side effects.
What in life is without side effects? All right, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Shane Morita. He is a surgical oncologist, and he's the director of the Queen's Surgical Oncology Program. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about what do we do with the overall picture when we have somebody who's diagnosed, treatment is recommended, what happens next? Now, as always, our conversation is yours as well, and you can join us at 941-3689. Toll free from our friends in the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
This year's musical fundraiser at the Polycoop is a celebration of the Hawaii in Hawaii Public Radio. New music created for each island by Kuana Torres Kahele, danced to by Mary Monarch winning Halau, the art of the lei, and Ono Hawaiian food. Join us for the day or just one of the two concerts featuring music for the Hawaiian Islands and bring five of your friends to enjoy a group discount. Let us tell you more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Humankind.
The sense of living always with the awareness of that silent guidance, that silent presence, makes all the difference in life.
We explore the Society of Friends, also known as Quakers, whose silent prayer can be more powerful than words. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace. Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, here with cancer expert Dr. Shane Morita. He's a surgical oncologist at Queen's Medical Center, and he's going to be giving an upcoming public lecture we'll talk about in just a few moments. Before the break, we were talking about what happens when you get treated with immunotherapy and what does that treatment mean? What is targeted therapy? And what we're going to discuss is what happens after you've been treated with cancer. And are you constantly under surveillance? Are you now a cancer patient for life? Now, as always, if you have some tips or you've learned some things or you're a cancer survivor, we'd love to hear from you and hear how important survivorship-type programs are for you. You can join us at 941-3689, toll-free Neighbor Islands 1-877-941-3689. Now, Dr. Morita, right during the break, you were telling me that you just got recent information on how many people who have cancer are survivors, and you've done some work with the National Cancer Institute, and what is the current statistic in 2016 and where are we headed?
So right now in the United States, there are 15.5 million cancer survivors, so patients living with cancer right now. In 2040, so about 25 years from now, there's going to be over 26 million. So it's really a growing, the trajectory is just phenomenal.
Now, when we talk about people who have received treatment, if they've done well with their treatment, how often do they get surveillance? How often do they come in? And I realize it's different for different types of diagnoses, but how often do they need to see the oncologist? And is there ever a time when they don't?
You know, it can be quarterly, it can be twice a year, it can be annually. It just really depends on the type of cancer. And also the stage, I think that's important. You know, we're early stage, so most cancers, as you know, are stage 1, 2, 3, or 4. So those are the four main stages, and stage 1 is early stage and stage 4 late stage. As far as what you can do is that we have a survivorship program, and many hospitals do here in the United States as well as nationally. And that person that can help develop a plan to, along with your doctor, work on a surveillance program. You asked me about certain cancers, if you ever need to, can you stop seeing your physician? And again, I think it really depends on the stage and also, quite honestly, the type of cancers. For example, colorectal cancer, 80% will recur within 2 years. So those patients are typically followed for about 5 years. Melanoma patients, I've seen melanoma patients recur more than 10 years out. Breast cancer is another one that can recur in a very delayed fashion. I think melanoma for me, because it's such an immunosensitive type of cancer that perhaps someone, there's a stress response or there's something going on where, you know, something is latent and develops, and that's why there's these late recurrences. I don't have any scientific explanation for that, but I think when I do see late recurrences, it's either from melanoma, or I know a lot of what's been published is breast cancer.
So you have some particular expertise with melanoma, with a variety of different types of cancers, but I know melanoma is one area where you are an absolute expert. And so you're seeing some of the late stage recurrences. So basically, if you have a cancer, you're probably going to continue to see that oncologist, whether it be your surgical oncologist or your medical oncologist, periodically for several years, if not upwards of 10 years, just to be monitored. And that's in addition to whoever you're seeing for the rest of your medical care. It sort of makes sure that you keep up with your blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, whatever other conditions you may have. But also don't forget, if you've had this problem with cancer, you still want to make yearly visits or however that schedule is determined. That's part of the timeline we talked about. Know how often you're going to need to follow up. And if you move, you can find another person to continue to follow up with. Don't just move and say, oh, well, I don't have it anymore. I don't have to go. Make sure you have that expertise available to you. Okay, we've got a phone call on the line. We've got Catherine from Maui. Catherine, welcome to The Body Show.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate all the information that you give us. And I'm calling today about a friend in Atlanta who, at her five-year checkup, it was discovered she had another tiny, really not sure what spot. But sudden, there's, of course, it's terrifying, and there's the great sense of urgency that is always directed to the patient, it seems, frequently. And so with her, it appears that the only option is mastectomy, because she has had this before, and the tiny spot is right almost on the scar where the other one was. And so, obviously, I don't know all of the details, but I'm wondering, you know, it's, as far as I know, slow-growing, certainly early stage. What can be done? I was interested in the immune therapy. What could be done short of something really drastic, like losing a breast, how can one explore other possibilities reasonably? When she asked one doctor, what if she did nothing, you know, she got the response, well, it can kill you. Well, that's not really very helpful. So do you have any kind of reassuring thoughts that there are things maybe that she could look into other than just simply immediately having?
Well, I'm curious, Catherine, just for the sake of being able to fully answer your question, how old is your friend?
She's in her 60s.
Okay. Is she a healthy woman in her 60s?
Very, very healthy.
Okay. Because yeah, I think,
She does have arthritis. I'm not sure just what autoimmune disease, which is why they don't want her to have implants.
Okay.
But she does everything to live kind of life for years.
Sure. And it seems like, you know, what we're dealing with is you're wondering. And this, I'm sure, Dr. Morita, you've had this happen. When, as a surgical oncologist, you say to someone, I think you need to have surgery to take care of this particular problem, and the person who has the cancer may want to look at other alternatives, what could they do that's not surgical? In that sort of situation, you know, it's an overall picture. And the reason, Catherine, I asked if, you know, the age of your friend and if she was healthy is that being in your 60s these days is, you know, 60 is the new 50, the new 40, you know, the new 30. I'm feeling better already. But really the idea is that if you're generally pretty healthy, then you may want to, if you have an expected lifespan of another 10, 20, you know, who knows how many years, you may want to be fairly aggressive at treating it. When you have people who come in with those sorts of concerns, Dr. Morita, if surgery is somewhat, shall we say, drastic in a way, but is curative, would that generally be something that would probably be better than medical therapy? I mean, it's difficult for the particular scenario, but
I think it depends. I think you need to do really determine to really make a determination that that's the only site of disease, you know, whether it's a biopsy, number one, just
that's a good point. Know that it's not anywhere else.
And really, so biopsy it. So get a piece of tissue and making sure that it is indeed, you know, a particular cancer. Number two is do some staging, meaning do some imaging, something where you get information to determine whether or not the cancer has spread, because it really makes no sense to do an operation that primarily treats cancer locally or even regionally in the lymph nodes if it's already spread to other parts of the body. So I think, you know, I'd need a little bit more information
before making recommendations. That's a great point, which is, you know, when we talk about doing treatment, let's just presume that Catherine's friend has had all those things done. The reason they may, and again, might be, we're sort of interpreting this, but the reason they might be recommending surgery is because maybe it hasn't spread anywhere else and the surgery could be curative, in which case it's probably going to limit the potential for this to spread while you're considering other treatments. Because really one of the issues is there are certain types of cancers, and do we really know how fast they grow? I guess sometimes we do, but if you have a recurrence at the site of a previous scar, you gotta wonder if that isn't going to be mutated enough if you've already had some type of chemo or radiation treatment to be resistant to those and therefore not be able to respond to your classic type of treatments that you did last time and require surgery. And although unfortunately implants are often something that women are not offered based on their other medical history or their other concerns, you know, you're dealing with truthfully, whether or not you want to do a treatment for a particular cancer type that could be curative versus something less than. And any other sort of therapy may be less than curative. If you have a question, and I'm sure you've had this occur, have you ever had people see you for second opinions and say, you know, here's all the data, here's all the information I have, here's what surgeon number one wants to do, what do you think about it? That's actually in some cases encouraged so people can feel more comfortable with what they're being told.
Yeah, in fact, I just saw one recently. I think I just provide my own opinion and advice, and I don't really, I guess, focus on what that other person
This
is my recommendation. And so then, you know, it's obviously up to the patient to make a decision. So, you know, oftentimes, for example, in my situation, when I do surgery, I don't see them more than once because we make a decision to have surgery and we schedule it. And that's why I think the rapport that you develop with your healthcare provider is extremely important. It has to be a chemistry, because it's not like I tell my patients, well, you know, why don't you come and watch me operate if you like what I do? Then
that would be kind of difficult.
You know,
yeah.
So I mean, you know, it's really a trust that you have to have. And if there is that, if the trust isn't there, I would say don't feel bad if you want to go and get a second opinion. I don't think that's, you know, I would advocate that. There's
sure.
any hesitancy.
Well, and I think often patients may feel like, I don't want to insult Dr. Morita by asking Dr. So-and-so about this. But in the medical world, truthfully, and I know this sort of crosses all class lines, all different medical center lines, but you know what often you are taught in medical school is how best to take care of an individual. And if that treatment is available where you are or where one of your colleagues works or at a separate medical center, wherever it may be, if the true goal is to do what's best for that patient, that's what's going to be recommended. And it's really based on what medical science is suggesting. And if you feel inclined that you want to get another opinion, feel free to do so. I'm not in competition with anybody else in any other medical center to see if I can do it better than them. It's really about trying to help someone find a way to get well. And in your case, to take out a tumor. So it's not like you would be insulted if one of your patients wanted another opinion. And they may still come back to you and say, I really want you to do this procedure. It's finding what they need to establish that rapport that'll help everyone to move forward.
Agree.
Now, you're going to be giving a talk upcoming this current Wednesday. And, you know, Queens Medical Center has done these great speaking engagements that are free to the community, that are just informational, and that really help to reiterate some of the stuff we talked about today, but give a forum where people can also ask questions and talk to experts and get to meet who the people are in the team. Tell me a little bit about the event.
Well, it's this Wednesday, 5:30 to 7 at Queens Conference Center. I think what's important, though, is I'm going to speak, but really the stars of the seminar are the patients that have gone through experienced treatment, whether it's be surgery or certain types of therapy, targeted therapy. We have a woman currently undergoing targeted therapy right now, so she's going to share her experience. And I think that, to me, is extremely valuable to get the patient's perspective.
Well, and any time you can have an opportunity to hear from somebody who's actually going through the treatment or has recently been through it, you know, a lot of times you and I think about, of course, this is what people need to know. This is what's medically important. And we forget what makes sense to the person who wants to know how they could possibly, you know, enjoy their birthday party if they're having trouble swallowing, or go to the hairstylist and have their hair done in such a way that no one really knows that some of it might be falling out, or whatever the treatment may be. There's stuff that we don't know until we've been there and done that. And that's where I think the most important parts of survivorship go, and what you can learn from your fellow patients that are right there fighting the same battle. Now, how can people find out more about it? Is there a place they can call? Is there a website they can go to? Because this is a series that Queens has put on about various speakers regarding health issues. And it's really an excellent public service that you do. And, you know, it's something that can allow folks to hear firsthand about how treatments are going for other people fighting the same fight.
You can go to the website, queensmedicalcenter.org. Also, there's a number, 691-7117, and that's the referral line, but they can give you information and specifics regarding the discussion that we're going to have on this Wednesday.
All right, and we'll put it on our Facebook page for The Body Show. So if you're looking for that, we'll put that connection there as well, because this is just an invaluable resource that will allow folks to hear firsthand. So you're right, you're part of it. But I kind of agree with you. I think the bigger part of it is going to be the patients who are there to share their story and sort of help people to realize that we're all in this together. It's all a battle that we're all fighting. Nobody wants to receive the knowledge or the words, hey, you have cancer. But once you do, it really can be a team effort, collective, to try and help out.
And it really is a life-changing word. You know, it really impacts, like I said, the whole family as well as the patient. And you know, it's really important, again, to get your friends, family members together and have a core team that you can lean on.
Well, and we talked about that, the things we need to do. Don't panic. Get organized. Do some research on your own. Why not? Share it with your doctors so that you're really educated and have questions, and huddle with your family members and your loved ones and your caregivers, and really try and identify who can help you go to these appointments so that they can also write it down. If I ever hear the words, I have cancer, I better not be expected to write anything down. I can barely read my handwriting now, let alone if I was upset and stressed about something. And then also get a timeline so you kind of know what to do, when to do it, when you should plan and anticipate having different aspects of treatment. So, you know, when we deal with cancer here in Hawaii, for all cancer centers that are NCI certified, they all provide a top quality level of treatment that is nationally recognized. And there's an audit that occurs every year. So you have to be following certain principles and guidelines in order to be a certified cancer center. And I know that that's a hard task. And Queens has gone through that process and has really tried to bring the latest, greatest treatment. And so thank you for being on again, Dr. Marita, and sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to have to do it again. If you'd like to hear this show again, or you want some of that contact information for the upcoming lecture series, you can go ahead and find us at The Body Show on Facebook. You can also click on hawaiipublicradio.org and follow the links to The Body Show. Our engineer today is David Chong. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We will see you next week right here Monday at 5 on The Body Show. We'll see you then.